starting my own business. I was already living with Jenny when I decided to accept the job offer from Giovanni to join him at Barlow Microcomputers. Another benefit was that the company was based in Bramfontein, which is virtually in the city centre. No more trips east, which meant an additional saving on petrol. Another problem solved. I went about my business selling Panasonic PCs and software. It was there that I met Cedric, a freelance software programmer who wrote various programs for stock control, debtors, creditors, etc. I made a number of sales that included his software, and although he was about 15 years older than me, we got on well and worked productively together. After about a year there, I decided it was crazy working for another company, making lots of money for them, so I decided that Cedric and I should do it for ourselves. I approached him with this idea, and he said, great, but asked how much capital I had available to invest in the new business. What do you need capital for? I asked. To pay our salaries at the end of the month, he said with a surprised look on his face. Oh, no problem. I'll make some sales and we'll have the cash to pay our salaries before the end of the month. I recall thinking how I hoped that when I got to his age, I wouldn't be so conservative. But then I remembered he was 35 years old, married with two children, at school, a housing bond to pay, etc., etc. So I decided not to hold it against him at the time. But I knew I had my work cut out for me when it came to getting him more optimistic about life. Me? I was 21 years old, newly married, and had nothing to lose. So we agreed to form a company. I resigned at the end of the month. We were in business, and I was a director of a company, or so my business card proudly stated. I was going places, at this stage on paper at least. But I hadn't forgotten about Standard Bank. I thought about them every time I drove past one of their ATMs. In our first month, I managed to get the sales we needed. In fact, every month we managed to survive. But it wasn't as much fun or as glamorous as I thought it would be. It was a tough slog, but I wouldn't give up. During this period, I regularly attended church services at my local Happy Clappy. My faith was strong, my desire to succeed was strong, my bank balance, well, I mean, that needed time. Our customers often paid us late, which meant we'd pay our personal creditors late for things like rent and car leases. I remember many an occasion when I didn't have the money to buy food, so we ate not much more than toast for our meals. I remember having to convince the repossessor not to take my car, as I would be able to make the outstanding payments in a couple of days. Yes, I learned about struggling financially, so I can empathize with people who have also faced such trying times. Lessons learned? 27. Starting a business is a big risk, so make sure that you have sufficient funding to tide you over whatever period is necessary until the business succeeds. 28. Never think poorly of people who live on the poverty line, as you never know when you might have to experience hardship. 29. No matter how far behind you get in your struggle with debt, always ensure you pay back everything that you owe, no matter how long it takes. We were selling a lot of custom-developed software solutions at the time. In other words, a customer would tell us what he wanted, computerized, and we would write the software to do it. Slowly things started picking up, and I managed to bring in more business than Cedric could keep up with. At this stage, I was responsible for sales, finance, administration, accounting, and designing the solutions, albeit in a fairly rudimentary fashion. In my frustration with the delay in getting these programs written, I decided to sit down and write the programs myself. Now, up until that point, I knew exactly nothing about programming, but we had a crisis looming on our hands. No delivery meant no payment, which meant no food. Not good. So I took some of Cedric's programming code and started. At first, he found this amusing, but he didn't know what I'd been told by Paul Jansen at Olivetti. I quietly stuck to the task. It wasn't long before I got the hang of it, and we managed to clear the backlog. I wasn't as quick at churning out code as he was, but my stuff was solid and worked. I was paying lots of attention to detail. Cedric was impressed, and he suddenly had a lot more respect for his young, naive partner. So there I was, doing just the thing that I'd wanted to do, working as a programmer. Life is funny like that. Lessons learned. 30. Never underestimate your own capabilities. If you are committed and prepared to work hard, you will almost always succeed. However, remember lesson 24, not to confuse confidence with arrogance. 31. If you do not try something, you will never know whether you could have succeeded or not. The next few years, we changed direction slightly and started writing software for the retail industry. It included modules for point of sale, debtors, stock, creditors, and financials. We developed a unique version for the liquor retailers and a more general version for other retailers. Our business grew, we hired more people, we were getting there, slowly but surely. In early 1984, I finally experienced and understood apartheid for the first time. Apartheid, or apartness, was a term coined by the government at the time. It was the National Party, the NP, that had prescribed this way of life for the country. What it basically meant was that we, the South African populace, were not born equal, and that the black populace was destined to be second-class citizens. They were an inferior race, according to the predominantly Afrikaans NP. Therefore, they should be subservient to the white people. They were not capable of or deserving of having any senior positions in South African society. Therefore, they should not be spoilt by being granted the privilege of living in the same suburbs, nor could they have a decent education. The fact that the National Party had been in power since 1948 was proof to the world that this was how South Africa was meant to be. Or was it? I grew up in a middle-class neighborhood with certain privileges. An event that I clearly remember was in early days of television, where one of the highlights of the year was to be able to watch the English FA Cup final live. This was special. I remember it was about 1975. I was a young teenager and I invited our weekend gardener to our house to watch this special event. To me, it was the most natural thing in the world to do, as he was passionate about soccer as I was. To my father, it was most unnatural, as he was passionate about having his lawn mowed on weekends and, not counting our domestic worker, had never invited a black person into his house. In the end, my strong will prevailed and the lawn had to wait a couple of hours. But the joy that I was able to witness on this young man's face while we watched the match being played on the other side of the world was amazing. The look on my father's face was, well, let's just call it confused. A couple of years later, I was in the army and being indoctrinated in the evil ways of the black man. I was educated as to how they would rape and plunder our wonderful country. Somehow I could never buy into that, but I soon learned that to challenge a half-wit's opinion in military uniform only resulted in extensive and life-threatening exercise sessions. So I guess I was young, naive, and possibly a confused citizen. So back to 1984, I had installed my software at a liquor store in Boksburg. Tony, the owner of the store, telephoned me one day to ask if I was prepared to go and see a liquor store in Vosloorus, one of the nearby townships. For the uninitiated, a township was a neat area that the NP decreed suitable for the black populace to live in. There they could do their own thing without bothering the white populace. No problem, I said, and proceeded to get the contact details of the prospect, who was keen to find out more about my software. I called him and set up an appointment to meet with him. He asked if I was prepared to come into the township to meet him. Of course, was my reply. In those days, it was extremely unusual for a white person to enter any township without a police or military escort. It was in the heyday of necklacing, which was a vigilante sport that took place in the townships. Any informant or Uncle Tom was publicly burned by placing a car tire around his or her neck. The tyre, doused with petrol, was then set alight and the person burned to death. For some reason, perhaps naivete, this did not faze me, so I drove into the township without any protection. As it turned out, they had two liquor stores, one called Fountain Uptown and the other Fountain Downtown. I saw the first fountain store and went inside. I was directed to the main man who was in his little office. He looked up at me and was surprised to see this young white man standing in his lair. He growled at me, or at least that's what it sounded like, which I interpreted as an invitation to speak, so I asked to see a Mr. Kuneni. He said that he was Mr. Kuneni and asked me what I was doing there. I said that we had scheduled a meeting, to which he barked that he did not schedule meetings with white men. He then said maybe it was with his brother who was at Fountain Downtown. He told me to drive another couple of kilometres down the road and I would find him there. I drove deeper into the heart of the township, and when I found the place, I was directed upstairs to a dark and dingy area. I knocked on the door and was told to come inside. A large black man was sitting behind his desk, shouting at some poor person on the other end of the telephone. He motioned to me to sit down, which I did. While he was conducting his telephone discussion, I let my eyes wander around his office. It was bare and dark, and I began to wonder whether he could afford to buy my inexpensive software. My army indoctrination and prejudices were beginning to show. He finally put the telephone down as I stood up and offered my hand in a traditional handshake gesture. He ignored me, so I sat down and thought about this barbarian's poor manners. He asked me in a deep, gruff, and very intimidating voice, "What the hell are you doing in my township, honky?" I was not expecting such a hostile attack, so at first I didn't know how to respond. The initial surge of fear was prominent, as I was now truly on my own. Visions of a necklace sprung to mind, but somehow I managed to blurt out, "Kaffa, I'm here because you need my honky brain to help you sort out your business." The next thing, his face burst into the biggest smile I'd ever seen, and he stood up, all 6'6" of him, and extended his giant hand and said to me, "We are going to be great friends." Somehow I managed to separate the seat of the chair from my posterior and stood up and shook hands with my new barbarian friend. From that day onwards, we had the greatest business and personal relationship possible. Although Zanossi was some 9 years older than me, we learned much about each other and from each other. Early in our relationship, he asked me if I played golf. At the time, I was new to the game, but I loved it. He was passionate about the game and played off a low handicap. He invited me to play with him and some of his friends, which I accepted. He told me he would be playing on Monday at one of the courses in that region. Why a Monday? I inquired quite innocently. "Because the course is closed and the caddies are allowed to play," he replied. I couldn't believe what I had heard, but I said nothing. On the Monday, I went with him to the course in his runaround vehicle, which was an upmarket BMW. When we arrived, the car park was full of the most expensive and exotic vehicles you could imagine. The rest of the players, some 20 to 30 of them, were all black men. They were doctors, they were lawyers, they were wealthy businessmen. Now, these fine men had gathered to play golf on a Monday, the only day of the week when the course was closed, so they could enjoy a round of golf. This was the most eye-opening experience I've ever had in my entire life. How could this be a just society when highly educated men of a darker pigmentation could only play on a Monday just because lesser educated men of a lighter pigmentation chose not to play on that day? I was no longer naive or indoctrinated. I was now a campaigner for civil rights. My entire world and belief system had changed in an instant. I used to visit Zanossi at his home in the township, and he visited me. We went to select restaurants together, or not all the restaurants were enlightened to the real world. We partied together, got into trouble together. He taught me about his culture. He was passionate about music, just as I am. We went to black jazz clubs, and everyone accepted me for what I was. I was Zanossi's white brother. He and his family of five brothers and one sister had become successful in business, even in those tough times. As the dispensation changed in the country, they became extremely wealthy in the years to come. They achieved this not because of affirmative action or black empowerment, but because of their exceptional business intellect and skills. To this day, in 2008, some 24 years later, we still remain close friends and have shared many business partnerships. Lessons learned? 32. Always question the views that you've been brought up to believe in, as they may not always be appropriate. 33. Never judge a person. Do not allow your preconceptions to form an opinion about anyone until you have taken the trouble to understand them. 34. When confronted with a direct challenge, do not necessarily issue a return challenge, as this could become confrontational. Never run away, though, as this will not earn you any respect. 35. Try and learn about any oppression there may have been in your own society. Spend time to understand the situation and do what you can to change it, if it is in conflict with your value system and belief. In the mid-1980s, we realized that in order to succeed, we had to be able to sell our software on a national basis. Our competitors had established branches throughout the country. Our solutions were rated far better than their offerings, but we did not have their national coverage. We didn't have the funds, so we had to find a big brother. By now, after a few years of working with Cedric, I had learned to deal with my frustration, which was a direct result of Cedric constantly changing his mind. We would agree on an issue one day, and by the next day he had changed his mind, but even worse, the following day he would change his mind again. I make up my mind quickly and set about doing whatever I have decided upon. Not Cedric. I was not sure how much longer I could tolerate the situation, but I persevered. We agreed to look for a company that would buy a stake in the business and provide the necessary funding for us to establish branches in the major cities. Cedric never liked the negotiating and selling aspects of the business, so he agreed to let me do the legwork. When I found some companies that I thought would be ideal, I would bring him into the loop. I spent a few months identifying suitable companies and meeting with them. I was looking for a similar ethos, a similar value system to our own. After all, we were going to be joined at the hip. We finally had two alternatives to seriously consider, from which we had to make a final decision. Cedric and I agreed on one specific company, so we decided to go ahead. Ohio Computer Systems was a fairly young but successful IT company that was listed on the stock exchange. I liked the three main directors. Peter, the chairman, was a recluse of sorts, but a technical genius. Norman, the managing director, was a superb salesman, and Rob, the financial director, was an experienced businessman. They already had offices in all the major cities in South Africa, so it was an ideal match. The contract negotiations began, and after a lot of haggling, we finally agreed on a contract. We met with them for the formal signing ceremony, followed by a little celebration with their board of directors. We were excited. We could now realize our dreams. We were going to get a reasonable cash payment up front. We had a great performance-linked bonus scheme and a potential for dividend payouts. Life was looking positive. 2 days later, Cedric changed his mind. When he told me, I was shocked but not surprised. Every clause that he had wanted in the agreement, I had successfully negotiated. He was happy with the agreement. After all, he had signed it. He then asked me to cancel the agreement and start the process of finding another partner all over again. It was then that I decided that enough was enough. I told him that if he was unhappy with the agreement, that he should approach them and deal with it. I was not prepared to renege on an agreement that I had signed and that I was happy with. He said that he didn't want to be part of it and was not going to. This was a power play on his part, as he never thought I would go ahead without him. I called his bluff and said that I would continue irrespective of what he decided. I remember him saying, You can't. You need me. My response was, no, Cedric. It would be nice to have you along, but please understand that I don't need you any more. With that, he stormed out of the office. Knowing that there was a great possibility of him changing his mind by the following morning, I left things as they were. The next morning he returned, and I asked him if he changed his mind, and he said no. So I agreed to get him out of the contract. I approached Peter, the chairman of the group, and explained Cedric's change of mind, but I told him that I was not willing to renege on the agreement. He was more than happy to continue, and we renegotiated a different contract with a larger upfront cash payment to assist me in buying out Cedric's shares. And so I parted ways with my partner of 6 years. Things were going reasonably well on the business front, but sadly, my marriage had all but collapsed while I was working, working, and working. Over the previous 7 years, I'd not taken any leave. We couldn't afford for me to be away from work, closing deals, writing software, etc. I worked 16 to 18 hours a day, 6 days a week. I would leave home by 6 o'clock and only get back by 10 o'clock. On Sundays, I played golf. On one occasion, for some reason during the week, I got home early at 6 o'clock, and the sun was still up. I can vividly recall the guilt that I felt. I felt I was cheating someone. I didn't know what to do with myself, so I hauled out my computer and continued to write software. It was crazy. I guess I was crazy. Lessons learned, 36. In any partnership, you are likely to have differences with your partner or partners, which is normal and natural, as you're not meant to complement each other in terms of strengths and weaknesses. It is important that these differences are properly managed and communicated, otherwise the partnership will be in danger of dissolving. 37. Never sign long-term contracts unless you are totally committed to honoring them. 38. Becoming a workaholic is as desperate as being a substance abuser. It is a selfish commitment which will cost you your relationships, whether with a spouse, children, or friends.